You are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indy Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Right here in sunny Coco, Florida, we are heard on AM 1510, WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and everywhere on the World Wide Web at WWBC. Today, we have an action-packed studio. We've got two candidates whose elections would be decided on August 23rd. So mark that date down. We've got Erin Dunn in studio with us, and she is a candidate for school board in District 2. And we've got Judge Jessica...
Rexedler,
which I have to say the name a few times. I've got to learn how to say it. She is up for re-election, and she's here in studio as well. And Allie, you're here with us. You're
taking
Ellen's place.
Ellen's
so do your spiel. Be Ellen today.
Ellen has a well-deserved weekend out in the country, so she can breathe for a moment. Both of our candidates are here with us today, and we'll speak to them individually. Erin Dunn and Jessica Rexedler are both paying for their visit here with us.
Right, their segments are paid for by their political
campaigns.
Part of the advertising from their campaigns. But before we start talking to Jessica, she's going to be first. You know, I just wanted our listeners to know, you know, I always do a little CETA social, a CETA-ism before the show.
And yeah.
I read this really nice article, and being a nurse, of course, Alzheimer's is something I talk about, and we've seen so many patients in the last 33 years with Alzheimer's. And I read this really nice article, and it talked about the new direction for Alzheimer's research. And there's this physician, his name is Dr. Vijay Ramnanan, and of course, he's Indian like myself, and mm-hmm. that caught my eye. He's a neurologist up at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And they're saying now that one of the ways that Alzheimer's could be, one of the ways to probably eradicate it is exercise. Not just the drugs, but they're thinking now that the data is suggesting that if you have a healthy, balanced lifestyle approach, you can help Alzheimer's. So today I'm asking all our listeners, you know, it's important that we all pay attention. We can't get rid of Alzheimer's at all because of what's going on with our brain and the plaque built up and everything. But I think they're getting to that point. Sometimes you wonder why people in their 80s and 90s are still gardening. And they're still okay.
Because they're staying active.
Exactly. I mean, I misspoke, not eradicate, but I think it's just one of those things that they think they can help. And it brought me back to my childhood in our villages, watching people in their 80s and 90s, you know, catching fish, gardening, building things, using their brain. And I think that's something for all of us to pay attention to.
Oh, yeah.
Even if it's 20 minutes a day or 30 minutes a day, do something. Because I believe it helps not only when you get older, but when you're younger as well. So I thought it was a good article to share about exercise that it's helping. Because the cost of drugs and taking care of Alzheimer's is really astronomical at this point, you know?
It is. And if you're not prepared,
it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. So anyway, so we've got our friend Jessica is here. And Jessica is running. She is already a judge. She is the first female chief judge out of Seminole County. She was Judge of the Year by Central Florida Women's Lawyers in 2021, Distinguished Service Award by Florida Council of Crime and Delinquency in 2020. You're endorsed by Brevard County Sheriff Wayne Ivey and Seminole County Sheriff Dennis Lemma, and also right here by State Attorney Phil Archer. So let's chat a little bit, Jessica, about your background. And, you know, you had limited resources growing up as a child, but you made yourself somebody. So yeah. Tell us what happened. Give us a play-by-play of your life.
So when I was 12 years old, and hello, thank you for having me on the show too, Sita.
You're welcome.
Essentially, when I was 12 years old, I was studying Constitution for an American History project. And as a matter of fact, I remember the teacher. Her name was Miss Shaker. And during that time, I decided I wanted to, fight for justice and become a judge. And I told my mother that that's what I wanted to do. And she said, well, you better get scholarships because that's the only way we're affording for you to go to college because we were on food stamps when I was a kid.
Yes.
So essentially, that's what I did. I worked really hard and I ended up getting academic scholarships to college. I went to Florida State, got an accounting degree from Florida State. And then I went from there and went to law school. I went to Stetson College of Law, and I was actually on the number one ranked trial team while I was there, and that's where I met my wonderful husband, who was been married to now for 22 years.
It's a beautiful love story, too.
Yeah, it's always about education and opportunities, right? It always is. But somebody motivated you. Who was the person in your life that motivated you to follow your dreams?
It's funny because my mom's a teacher, or was a teacher, I should say. She's been retired, of course, now several years. She was in the school system for 39 years in Seminole County. She taught for 26 years and then was an administrator. And so it's always teachers. Like, that teacher sat down going through the Constitution with me to explain the circumstances, the Bill of Rights, and it just inspired me. And as a matter of fact, it was so known that I wanted to become a judge that when I graduated high school, one of my other former teachers gave me a crystal owl with a note that said, may all your decisions be wise, and a gavel with a note that said, may you exercise the right temperament. And when I was elected in 2010, they both now sit in my chambers.
Oh, perfect. My gosh. So you didn't want to become an attorney, a judge. You just knew a judge.
I
wonder why.
To be a judge.
Was there something in your life that you thought needed a person to be fair and balanced and experienced like yourself?
I think I always had a sense of fairness,
right and wrong,
like injustice. I was bullied a little bit as a kid, so I think just the sense of it now, now it's looked at differently than it was then, so I think the sense of fairness and injustice of the world, I wanted to make
level
the playing field,
right.
And I think that being an attorney, which I granted, I became a litigator. But being an attorney was a means to an end because you can only advocate as an attorney. You can't make those decisions to make sure and try to ensure justice. And actually, that's one of the questions I ask, my husband and I both ask, even when him as an attorney, was justice done today? Was the right thing done today? Because that's what I try and do the most with everything, is to do what's right.
And people always ask us when we have people running for office for re-election or just to become a judge, they always want to know the difference between a county court and a circuit court judge.
So, and that's important because my race is the only circuit race for Brevard and Seminole counties. And essentially, county court is where it involves misdemeanors, crimes that are punishable by imprisonment in the county jail for less than 1 year, and also involves small claims cases or civil cases where the amount in dispute is less than $30,000 and landlord-tenant cases, things of that nature. Whereas circuit court involves circuit. There are 20 circuits in the state of Florida, 67 counties. So each county has their own county judges. Then you have 20 circuits. Brevard and Seminole touch in this imaginary spot in the middle of the St. John's River. that is essentially why we became a circuit in 1968. And it's important to know, too, that Brevard sits in Brevard and Seminole sits in Seminole, and my seat is in Seminole. So that's the way we kind of do it. But the circuit judges hear cases that are punishable by imprisonment in state prison for more than a year, all different as far as thefts, drug cases, sex crimes, death penalty cases, and then cases that are civil cases that involve the amount in dispute more than $30,000, medical malpractice, personal injury, any cases involving property, foreclosures, and eminent domain. And then those are all jury trial cases. And then cases that don't involve juries, such as probate of estate cases, when people die, all the family cases, such as divorce proceedings, child custody, time-sharing, and child support proceedings, as well as juvenile cases, juvenile delinquency or dependency, when essentially somebody has to go into the home because something's going wrong with the parents. That's all done by circuit judges.
I know.
That's absolutely amazing. That seems like that's more than a handful to be able to do all of that sort of thing.
It's a lot different in circuit court than it is in county court. I can say in Brevard, they have all the divisions are divided a bit more than they are in Seminole. So
you can kind of specialize in a couple, three of those things?
So in Brevard, they have separate, you have a separate probate division, separate family division, separate civil division, criminal division, and separate juvenile delinquency, and then juvenile dependency. In Seminole, we only have three. We have criminal, juvenile, which does delinquency and dependency, and then civil, family, which does everything civil and everything family.
Yeah.
So,
so
right
what
now,
stands civil- out to you most since becoming a judge? Something that you've experienced, good or bad, you know, what is it that stands out?
Well, I mean, as a judge, and especially a circuit judge, you're not that you're not with county, because they call it the people's court. They have a direct aspect with the people, but essentially you have, in circuit court, you're dealing with a lot more emotional cases. I mean, with crimes, you're dealing with somebody's freedom where you can be taking away, they're going to prison for a long time.
Yeah.
Or with family, you're dealing with possibly their children and what's going on with that family.
Right, the family unit, yeah.
The family unit, yeah. How that's going to be decided.
And a lot of socioeconomic things, too. You see a lot of that.
And the same thing in civil. So I think the hardest thing for a judge is when you, and it's something that you have to learn, is really your job is to remain unemotional, and also, and you have to just follow the law and to not show that emotion, especially with juries.
Yes.
Because you have to make sure that you appear impartial, and it can be difficult. It takes about 6 months for a new judge to be able to learn that or become accustomed to it. I know I had a really severe child abuse case that was at the time a little bit high profile. And when I first got on the bench, and it was a 5-day jury trial, and when I came home, I remember my husband just asked me, what was the verdict? And I just started crying. So, because I'd held that emotion in all week long, and I was a new judge.
Yeah, because you guys are humans, too. Yeah.
We are.
Yeah.
So those cases, they're still, so I think that's part of a judge that a lot of people don't see or understand.
Yes, that impartiality presence, mm-hmm. Yeah, makes a difference. And for me, I have facial movements that I make when I think, you know, are you kidding me kind of thing.
Yeah, judges have to be careful. So for our listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with our friend Jessica Rexedler. She is she's up for re-election. She is a chief judge here in the 18th Judicial Circuit. And we're finding out all the great things about her and why people should re-elect her on the 23rd of August. So Jess, let's just ask you a question here. What kind of things do you do for fun? Because I mean, you've got a high power job and you also have a family. So we want our listeners to get to know you. What do you do? What kind of hobbies do you have?
It's a balance. It's funny you did say about the dementia thing, because actually I went through that with my father up until last year. He passed away in December, but he had a dementia. So a lot of spare time went to him as well. Besides, it's my family. I mean, my family is my rock, and God. So those, and I spend a lot of time with them. The beach, we like to go to the beach a lot and spend time there and hang out on the beach. Otherwise, just kind of chilling with some popcorn and watching a movie with my kids. I try, and sometimes too with my daughters, because I have two daughters, one 16 and one 19. When they'll read books, I try and read books with them. So then we have something to talk about. So when we're reading the same books, like when my one daughter did all the Divergent series. I did those and the Hunger Games. So we read them together. Yeah. So then we had something we could talk about the books.
Yeah, because your job as a circuit court judge, you deal with a lot of emotional issues. And how do you deal with it emotionally? I mean, you have to disassociate yourself from a lot of these cases as well.
Right. Like I said, it's something where essentially you have to train yourself to not show emotion. So you do have to, and you can tell I talk with my hands. Nobody can see you because we're in the studio. But I talk with my hands a lot. I've got that Italian background. So, and to learn to be not as expressive, because you want to make sure, because the people are looking to the judge, and you never want to appear that you are appearing biased or, you know, and that you're not impartial on what's going on, because your job is to follow the law, to make sure that the law is being applied properly, and to doing your best to listening to everything and applying to it. But you do have those emotional issues, and you have to just separate yourself out from there, because that's not part of the job.
Can you explain like your judicial philosophy to our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends?
Essentially, the way I look at it is, like I said, it's the legislature's job to create the law. If you have a problem with the law, and there are people in the courtroom who do express that they don't like the circumstances of the ruling, and it's not, I tell them, well, then if you have a problem, I'm sorry, but that's not me to change that point of view or that issue. That's, you have to go to the legislature, because my job, I'm applying the law as it's written, and it's not my job to legislate from the bench.
Right.
So that's what I'm supposed to
do. You follow the law.
So I follow the law, and I believe that it should be strictly followed as to how the law is
right. Listen to both sides and follow the law, right?
And our job is not to judge as far as the law. We're making a judge of the facts. A lot of people say you sit in judgment, but you're judging the facts and the evidence that's presented, and then you're just applying it to the law
that's
already written.
Yeah. Do you think we should have any changes made to our justice system? Like, is there anything you think that needs to be done in your view, what you're seeing, maybe with backlogs, streamlining cases and things like that?
Well, I can say as far as backlogs, the 18th Circuit is doing extremely well, especially compared to the other 19 circuits in the state. We did, as a matter of fact, trying to keep the courts open. I actually got the leadership award from the Titusville Police Department this year, because as chief judge, trying to keep the courts open and exercising the appropriate social distancing and masks and things rather than shutting everything down, because I wanted to keep it going. And that helped in not having the backlog that we have. So we're actually pretty caught up in our circuit, especially compared to others. But I can say my passion, I'm the adult drug court judge for over the last more than 11 years, or almost 11 years in the circuit. And I have essentially, I think, the mental health and substance abuse facilities as chief. That's something that I'm working on to try and improve those and expand those, especially because juveniles facilities and their treatment for mental health and for substance abuse is lacking. And even in Seminole, we have no Marchman facilities, and we drive them all the way to Brevard. So I'm trying to expand those both in Brevard and Seminole to help solve that issue, so that way you don't have people reoffending, recommitting crimes,
right?
Because you're solving the problem. Because honestly, I personally believe about 80% of crimes are caused by some type of mental health or addiction, because they're either stealing because they're trying to get their drugs, they're on the drugs and that's why they have the possession or trafficking, or they are hurting somebody because there's some type of issue with substance.
And you know, we all say all the time that you are the environment in which you're raised, and some people just don't come out of that environment. You're right. So it is a socioeconomic issue for a lot of people, why they steal, why they commit crime and all that. But how does it feel, Jessica, to be the first female judge out of Seminole County? I mean, that is a big deal for me.
First female chief judge?
Yes, first female chief judge. I mean, that to me, that's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
Yeah, I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Actually, it was, I was pretty excited about it. Essentially, even being chief, it's another way. I always wanted to do this, like I said, since I was 12, because I wanted to make a difference. And it's another way for me to help the community and to make a difference and to be the first female coming from Seminole County. That to me, especially since there are 27 judges in Brevard and 16 in Seminole, that was a very nice circumstance.
Yeah, I would think. And I would think is your mother still alive? Because you had your father passed away. Yeah. So she's probably really proud of you too. I mean, I would be. So. I mean, I know when my daughter took her oath when she became an attorney, we cried. I mean, it was like, it's the most moving experience to see your child become an attorney and uphold the law of this beautiful country and love the land and try to make a difference. It's just beautiful. I could just imagine. So, you know, people always ask us, like when we have judges on, like ask them if they can define what an injustice is. Do you want to take on that question?
I mean, the only thing I can say as far as an injustice, because there's a difference, I think, in some people's minds between moral injustice and legal injustice.
Right.
And they're not necessarily the same thing. And sometimes they can be. So I think that's, and that's again where there may be something, because there are times, unfortunately, where judges, I would say, can sometimes have to enforce the law on something, but that maybe in that particular circumstance don't believe that it's necessarily always the right thing, because our legislature, for instance, have created sentencing guidelines. And so based upon the sentencing guidelines, if there's a scoring system. And within a certain part of the scoring system, we have a lot of discretion. But then in another part, we don't. So it may be a circumstance where, you know, somebody may score a certain point, but it's basically because the type of crime that they had.
Right.
It's not because of something else. So in that instance, it may be they possibly could have the circumstance where they could be rehabilitated. But we don't have the luxury of departing from that unless we find certain factors.
You can't switch
in the
it
statute,
around. You can't switch it around, yeah.
Whereas the state attorney can do it for any reason they want.
Right.
So they actually have more discretion than the judges do, because no matter what the score, the state attorney can decide to change what the sentence is.
Yes. Yeah. And that's when, you know, like a lot of us love it when we have people who are experienced and knowledgeable and fair. Like, you're very fair-minded. And so I thank you for that, because it comes across to me, and I'm sure it comes across to listeners as well, that the reason why you will be reelected is because you're fair to people and you listen to both sides. And, you know, it's not black and white. You do have that. You do listen, which is great. And I think we've always said that one of the greatest qualities of being a judge is listening and communication. Can you add anything else to that? What makes a great judge?
I think definitely listening.
Qualify somebody to be a great judge.
Definitely listening is number one. I think having the appropriate temperament is definitely something, because you have to be a good listener. You have to be willing to hear both sides, though, of the circumstance and evaluate both sides and have the knowledge to being knowledgeable about the law, to being able to appropriately apply it. It is much different when you're advocating on one side and on the other side of the bench than it is the way you think on this side of the bench, because you have to also be open-minded. You have to be able to see and listen to both sides open-mindedly. So that way you hear the evidence from both sides to make your decision and knowledgeable about the law to do it appropriately. Because that's the other thing. If it's somebody's more skewed or one-sided, that can make a difference. And I do believe having the appropriate temperament, and I think having compassion. I do believe that a judge in some senses should have compassion for not necessarily the, at least in dealing with the people. When they're in the courtroom, understanding a lot of people are nervous when they come to court. They're scared when they come to court. And to be able to understand that and somehow put them at ease, I think that also helps and makes a difference.
Right. And I would think with your background, too, practicing a certain type of law helps as well. So tell our listeners, what type of law did you practice before you got elected?
I started off originally at the state attorney's office in Orange County. Even though I lived in Seminole, I traveled there.
Do a lot of driving.
I do a lot of driving. It's funny because my very first campaign, I put 70,000 miles on my vehicle campaign.
Wow.
When I ran that year. And that shows you also how hard I work.
When I look at you, Jessica, I feel like you do the job of 10 women in one day. I feel like you do a lot of stuff.
I do work hard, and I will definitely get the job done. I mean, like I said, besides working, I'm campaigning in my spare time, so a lot of that, it makes a difference. And the first time around, I did the same thing. So I still worked full-time, because at that time, so after I left the state attorney's office, I went into private practice, and I practiced both civil and criminal litigation, all aspects, commercial, construction, personal injury, insurance defense, as well as probate litigation, and then got into what became a firm that became my firm as well, which I became a partner in. And I tried cases both civilly and criminally for both plaintiff and defense, prosecution and defense. I've gotten $1 million verdicts on the plaintiff side, zero defense verdicts on the defense side, and I'm a board certified civil jury trial expert by the Florida Bar. Out of 109,000 lawyers in the state of Florida, only approximately 120 women have that distinction, and I'm one of them.
Oh, wow. Boy.
Excellent.
It is, I'm telling you. Yeah. So, I mean, oftentimes people run for office, and then there's always this word that comes up, equality. Right. So how do you work to ensure that people from all backgrounds do feel like there's equality for all in the courtroom?
Well, I can tell you there was a survey done, I think it was 3 years ago, for every circuit, where they looked at the sentencing structure for every circuit. Like I said, you do have discretion, certain scoring, and the judges who were in criminal courts in those circuits and had been in criminal courts in the past in their sentencing structure to see biased. And currently, I'm the least biased judge who is sitting in the, as far as the 18th Circuit, at least according to that survey. Besides that, when you walk into my courtroom, like I said before, you're a person. So it doesn't make a difference if, like, people look at me initially and think, you know, that I came from a different socioeconomic background than I did. But I didn't. Everybody's different. You don't judge a book by its cover.
Yes.
Everybody comes from, so it doesn't make a difference what ethnic background you are, what socioeconomic background you are. You're a person, and you deserve to be treated as such.
That's because you look so young, too.
Oh, I turn 50 next month.
You look great.
Listen,
thank you.
50 years
dynamic, fantastic. And I'm sure she makes time to exercise as well, like the article said.
I
mean, it's so important, right? But You know, the other thing too, when people are running for office, they always tell us when they come on the show about endorsements, and you've got quite a few. So let our listeners know about some of the endorsements that you've had, Ms. Jessica Rickslider.
Rex Seidler. Just remember Jessica for Judge.
You know, I like your sign. I swear to God, I see your sign all over Brevard, and it says Jessica for Judge, and I'm so happy. I'm like, I could never say that last name. Yeah. It's like my last name.
Jessica. I'm Judge Jessica. I know, I married into it. Not a lot of people can pronounce it.
So. My name on my passport is Sita Durjan Ishmael Biggie. The Homeland Security people, they're like, just go. Yeah. Just go. We don't want to even attempt saying that name.
I've had so many variations of that name, of my name. But as far as the endorsements, I mean, essentially the way I look at it, I've got endorsements from all different stakeholders, all different constitutional officers. It's not a matter of party, not party backgrounds. It's a matter of all the stakeholders that I work with on a regular basis from all different aspects, because as chief judge, I have to work with these people, and it shows how well I work with them that they're willing to endorse me. I'm also endorsed by the past president of the Florida Bar. Current president can't endorse me, but who oversees those 109,000 lawyers, as well as the president of the Florida Justice Association, and who all the head of the trial lawyers, as well as the past president of the Florida Justice Association. And I've been either had contributions at this point or endorsed by over 300 lawyers on my campaign, which are the people that practice in front of me on a regular basis. So I think that shows just how well I work with people and how they work with me.
Yeah, you're very comfortable to speak with. And I think when people come into a courtroom, they're already nervous. They're taking a day off. They have to use a vacation day. They have to think about daycare. Whatever's going on into single parents, whatever. And when you have somebody who you see as fair and friendly and open-minded and experienced and has the knowledge to decide a case, I think it puts people at ease. And I believe that's what all citizens want anyways, right? Politics is about making people's life easier.
I have 25 years. At the end of this month, there'll be 25 years of legal experience, and I have over 11 years of judicial experience. I have definitely more legal and judicial experience than my opponent. Less legal.
You are a leader, my friend. So there's always events when you're running for office. Is there any places nearby or maybe in your town where people can meet you and try, if they want to hear about your campaign, maybe donate, volunteer? Give us your website and where they can find the events.
My website is Jessica, the number 4, judge.
Thank God.
And my phone number is 407-921-7102, and you can contact that number, and I personally, I usually try and call back if it's as far as if left messages left, so that way I can answer any questions they may have.
Right, and we just want to give a shout out. You know, when people throw the hat in to run for office, it really takes a toll on the family, and you have a wonderful husband and a family at home behind you, because you couldn't do this driving all over Brevard and Seminole and Orange. It's amazing.
I tell him all the time, he's my calm and my strength.
Yeah.
I mean, so with my husband, definitely is my calm and my strength, and I'm more in love with him now than the day I married him. I have two great kids. My daughter actually just went home yesterday to college in North Carolina, so she went back to college, so that was a little rough day for me. And then my other daughter is 16 and is in high school still, so I still have one.
And so before we go off air, if you were to meet someone in an elevator, or you meet them just in the yard outside and they see the sign Jessica for Judge and they say, why are you running for re-election? What would be your quick little blurb that you say to them why they should vote for you, a fair-minded person like yourself?
I have the experience, like I said, 25 years legal experience, as well as over 11 years judicial experience, so I'm qualified. I've wanted to do this since I was 12, and I care about the community. I care about the job, as indicated, and so I'm caring as to the people and trying to improve the mental health and substance abuse and everything that goes on with the community. And like I said, I still am trying to achieve as chief and being elected by my colleagues to be chief, which shows I'm committed to the community, committed to the courts, and committed to my job.
And Allie, wouldn't you say she's a role model, too, for our young women and girls?
Oh, I was just thinking about her two daughters and what they could have and have learned from you. And that's nothing better than that.
We're all learning. We're all learning. So give us a website.
That's what I aspire to be, is to always be, as far as make sure at least my campaign, when I run a campaign, that it's a campaign, it's a clean one, and a campaign that my girls, when at the end of it, can always be proud of me, if no matter what happens. My website is jessica4judge.com. And again, my phone number is 407-921-7102.
Well, Jessica for Judge, we are grateful that you took the time to come by and Viewpoint with Sita and Friends and support our show, and also, more importantly, pay for the segment from your political campaign funds. We really appreciate it, and I wish you well. The date is August 23rd, and people can vote by mail. They can vote in person. Do you know when does the early voting start?
Early voting is August 13th. In Brevard, it's from 8 to 6. In Seminole, it's from 10 to 6. And it's August 13th to August 20th. And then the polls open from 7 to 7 on the date of August 23rd. And I'm the only, just remember Judge Jessica, if you can't remember Rex either.
JJ.
I am the only, like Judge Judy, just remember Judge Jessica. I'm the only Jessica on the ballot.
Yes. Well, another great segment on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And we'll be right back, folks, with Erin Dunn for School Board District 2.
Family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at cloud9furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. Just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great tasting seafood, char grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low cost sandwiches and baskets to high end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And we had a very, very robust first segment with Judge Jessica Rexleiber. I said it right. Rexleiber.
Rex Seidler.
Rex
Seidler. Well, how come we always get it at the end of the show, Rex
Seidler?
We're
just going to spend every moment in the break saying it over and over again.
Yes, yes, yes. And our second segment now is with Erin Dunn. Oh, my God, it's easy to say Dunn because my podiatrist name is Dunn. So it's easy to say that. So, Erin, you're here. You're running for school board in District 2.
Got it.
And so tell us a little bit about yourself. What made you decide to, you're a school teacher, but now you're running for school board. Are you still teaching?
So I was in the classroom. So I've taught for 13 years. I have been an elementary music teacher here in Brevard County for 11 years. And the fall of 2020, long story short, I was high risk for COVID. And I was facing going back into the classroom with 700 students per week, which, you know, my dad had passed away about 2 years previously. It was very, very difficult on my son. They had a very close relationship. So, you know, at that time, when we didn't know a lot about COVID, I decided to step away from the classroom, and I started actually my own music studio. I have about 40 students. I have some homeschooled students, some private school students, and some public school students that I teach music lessons to right now. So I've been doing that for about the last almost 2 years.
That's great. That's like still teaching.
Absolutely,
but, you know,
yes.
Doing it with your way you'd like to in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah. And I, you know, you asked why did I jump in this race? I would say that I just believe in public education so much. And working in the schools only got me more excited to stand up for our public schools because, you know, we have so many kids coming from so many different backgrounds. Kind of like you all were talking about earlier, you know, people in our community come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, and different amounts of privilege. And I think it's so important that we have public schools that are there to serve students in every community.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to stand up to help our public schools be strong, you know, and whatever our kids bring to school with them, we are able to address, you know, those challenges and help every student to be successful.
Right. And, you know, oftentimes we focus so much about the schools that we forget about the environment in which the kids are coming from. If you want to fix public schools, you've got to put resources into the
support
communities
families.
As well.
Yep.
Because you can't have a kid come into school with a hungry stomach or a place that he didn't have electricity to do homework.
Right.
Or somebody to help do the homework, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so you just can't have that. So I think people miss that mark a lot when they say something about public school and a quality education. It's also about where is the child coming from.
And, you know, one thing I'll say to that is lately there's been a little bit of a push of, you know, get back to the basics. We need to teach reading and math. And I agree that those are so important. You know, reading is so fundamental to success because you can't, you know, learn social studies if you can't read about our country's history, things like that. But I will tell you that I've worked at three very different schools. And when children come from backgrounds where they're not supported at home for whatever reason, or families lack certain resources, they can't learn, you know? And so it's so vital that some of our public schools, or all of our public schools really, are there to meet some of those extra needs that kids have. Because if we want them to be successful, we have to meet them where they are. We were actually just at Endeavor Elementary. My campaign had a fundraiser last Friday. And so we had a big balloon arch, and we were trying to figure out what to do with it. So we called up Endeavor, and we said, hey, would you guys like this for the first day of school? And so we delivered it over there, but it was so big that in the process of delivering it, a bunch of the balloons fell off, and so we were in the cafeteria putting pieces back together, and we had a discussion for quite a while as we were doing that with one of the employees there, talking about all the things that that school does for children. And students who shower at the school regularly, or a little boy who didn't speak English and would always come in the hallway, running down the hallway in the morning. And he didn't wear shoes. He'd come to school in his socks. Oh. And this particular woman worked in the front office, and she would try to catch him, but he was fast. And she finally found out he didn't have shoes. Not that they didn't fit, but he didn't own.
Allie, and I'm sure Allie's been around longer than we have. Allie Tambor is here. Allie Tambor is here. Her, she's a good friend of our show. She's our show's resident, and she's filling in today for Ellen O'Neill. So, Allie, you've seen a lot of that in your time, and wouldn't you agree that we do have to put a little more resources into the community to fix the community schools?
Exactly. The same way that you would be helpful to someone who was learning a new job, and ask them questions. What do you know about this? Do I need to explain how to turn this on or all those things? All of that should be happening in with the students as well. You know, do you know what the alphabet is? Do you know, whatever that might be, to make sure that you're reaching each one of your students in your class.
Right, no matter which zip code they come from, right?
Exactly.
So, Aaron, one of the things you're running on, one of your core issues, keeping schools safe. When you said we want to keep the schools safe, are you speaking about safe as in from criminals getting in with guns, or safety as far as buildings and infrastructure? Let's talk a little bit about school safety.
Sure, absolutely. I'll go ahead and start with, you know, I've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of parents and community members over the last few months as I've decided to run for office. And with the, you know, school shooting in Texas, I've had many parents asking about school safety. And so I really needed to do my research in order to, you know, if you're going to run for the school board, then you really have to know what are the best practices. What does research say will actually keep our kids safer? So here's what I found via my research, and here's what I've, you know, discovered. I fully support our school resource officers, and I'm not sure if you know, some of our schools in Brevard County have school resource officers, and some have school safety specialists. They're paid for in all different ways. Some of the schools are funded from the school district through the Brevard Sheriff's Office, and we also have some municipalities, some cities who fund those school resource officers. But I think it's fantastic that Brevard County makes that a priority. I would say that my focus would be to make sure that we have enough training for those people so that they feel that they can do their job very effectively, and that we continue to ask the state and our cities to continue to support that program.
Now put the children first.
Absolutely.
And their safety.
And what I'm not in favor of, though, I will say, is arming our teachers, because I did my research, and we know that in states where that has been a choice, we know that children have gotten their hands on weapons, and there have been accidental shootings and accidental misfirings of guns at schools. I will tell you that the National Association of School Resource Officers has actually spoken out against arming teachers as well, because they say...
It's a distraction, too.
Yes, and when you have an active shooter situation, it causes more confusion than the benefits they see. So, like I said, I like to do the research and make the real decisions that will keep our kids safe.
And how do you propose to help the teacher and the staffing? Because we're watching what's happening in some of the schools, the overcrowding, the lack of teachers. I mean, we can't even find substitutes in some areas. What is your plan to help that?
I think we have a multifaceted problem, and it's not just here in Brevard County. It's not even just here in Florida. You know, this is a nationwide issue with teaching right now and the teacher shortage. I think it was the Washington Post that just had a huge article that just came out about this. In talking to teachers in Brevard County and school staff, the number one concern that I have heard from them is actually student behavior right now. And I think there's a number of reasons, but I would say that we had a lot of kids who were home for a while during COVID.
Almost 2 years.
Yeah, some of them. And I think that it's just been a hard time, you know? We have families that have lost family members through COVID. We have kids who were home without a lot of supervision. So I think a lot of kids got used to kind of doing their own thing. And so now coming back to the structure of school, where expectations might be higher, or they might have to work harder than they were used to catch up academically, I think that we definitely need to have resources in place and in our schools to address those student behavior concerns. Now, here's what I will tell you, though. When I had students, you know, as a music teacher, I would always teach every child in my school. So whether that was about, you know, 1,000 students or whatever that was. And so I will tell you that my experience as a teacher tells me that those behavioral concerns, the number one way that I can address that is by building relationships with my students and their families. And so we need to make sure that we have, number one, we need to give our teachers autonomy. And that does not mean that teachers should be able to teach whatever they want. Of course, they're teaching the standards and things like that, right? But what that means to me is our teachers have a few minutes here and there to bond with our children, you know, to bond with our kids, to establish that family relationship in the classroom so the kids respect each other and they know each other and the teacher knows our children. So, you know, if they have an off day, the teacher can say, hey, what's going on? You know, did you eat breakfast this morning? You know, when our teachers get to know our kids, and can build them up and build up their self-esteem. Then when something happens, when they have, you know, a behavioral issue later, our teachers have the ability to say, hey, let's talk about what just happened.
Yes, you know? Yeah.
And so, but sometimes we need additional resources. So having school social workers in every single school and having guidance counselors who are not just there to do lots of paperwork, but can actually pull those kids out of
class, be an assistant. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
When kids are really struggling, you know, and be there to support our teachers, I think would be just fantastic.
I think Allie's going to jump in here.
So keeping diverse and high quality books and curriculum in the schools, it's very scary to me as an old lady to think about what they're, I'm hearing on the news with regard to, we're taking this out, you can't do this in the school book. And I don't remember having any issues with that growing up, but perhaps that was already taken out before the book got to me when I was in the mid-50s, you know? How does that play into what your plans are?
So the reason this is happening, well, I should say this. Over the last week, I have gotten so many messages and pictures from teachers in Brevard County of the curriculum and the books that they are not allowed to use. And one of the issues right now is every school is interpreting guidelines differently. I have a former colleague who reads aloud a book to her class every year and bases her whole first week of lessons on it and has these wonderful lesson plans. And it's all about, you know, the kids getting to know each other, and it involves writing and math and reading. She was told she could not read that book aloud on the first day of school to her class, and she's done it for 20 years. Other teachers are being told to cross off their classroom libraries, put under construction signs up. Other teachers are being told to lock up all of the books in their classroom.
It's almost like they're instilling fear,
yes,
in the teachers.
Just
like,
in case.
If you don't do this, yes, your job is on the line.
Just in case, you know, a substitute teacher was to come in and pick up a book off the shelf that was not allowed. Now, we know this is coming from legislation from Tallahassee. And, of course, the hope is once these books are vetted, they will, you know, the vast majority of them will be back in the classroom, will be able to be used. Unfortunately, right now, what this is doing is this is undermining the professionalism of teachers. And this is telling teachers, we don't trust you. We know, yeah, that you've been teaching for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and you've never done anything that would cause us to question your judgment. You've been in this for the kids. And now we're saying to these teachers, we don't trust what you're doing. We don't value your professionalism. And that's why we're losing so many teachers. But Allie, back to kind of what you said about our books. You know, the reality of the situation is that the vast majority, I mean, I'm talking 99.9% of the books in our libraries are appropriate for kids. And Brevard County already has structures in place that if books are not appropriate, that there are two things that can happen. Number one, a parent is allowed at any time to let the schools know that they do not want their child to read a specific book. And I support
and
that.
And that's always been in place.
Absolutely, yeah. And
yeah,
I support
my
that.
My kids went to public school. That's always been in place.
Sure. And there, you know, maybe one day there will be something I don't want my son to read.
Yes.
So I support that for sure. And right now, Brevard County has established a team of parents and teachers and school staff at the district level to address these book bans. What I'm hoping that does is that takes some of the weight off of the people in our different schools. So, and I hope that this team will be focused on the law, you know,
yes,
and what is allowed and what is not. And I know that they will make sure that when we look at book challenges, we know that there is an unproportional amount of diverse books and books by diverse authors being challenged. And I think that as our community grows more diverse, our libraries cannot be moving in the opposite direction.
Right.
No. And you know, we have to look like them.
Absolutely.
Right. And you know, we talked a little bit about the kids coming back to school from COVID. My grandchildren went through COVID. They did the remote learning. I have friends that did it. My daughter is a substitute teacher. I think that everything starts in the home, right? The foundation for learning starts in the home. We are a village, whether we know it or not. Grandmothers, aunts, cousins, family members. I mean, discipline in children should not be left up to only the teachers at school.
Indeed.
Because teachers are having a hard enough time telling little Johnny and Susie and Frank, sit down in your seat, open your book, go to page 13, or go to chapter 12, go to the second paragraph. It's about listening and communication. If the parents are not doing their job at home to make sure their child goes to bed on time, make sure he has breakfast, make sure homework is done, the book bag is packed. Look at me. I went to the school today and got my granddaughter's schedule and put it on her table before she comes home from her trip. So it's there. I mean, it's called preparation, right?
And responsibility. Of
course, yeah, we understand some people don't have that, but for the most part, yes, we have to do our part at home to help our teachers. And this is where I think sometimes people get a little confused about what is parental involvement versus parental control. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the Moms for Liberty here in Brevard. They're not the only ones that care about children's education. We do too. And a lot of us understand that when you talk about children and the school system, yes, it has to be age-appropriate materials. We all agree, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah.
So,
you know, here's what I would say about that. You know, my son has been in our public schools, has been in public school since kindergarten. We actually homeschooled him for a semester through COVID, but otherwise he's been in our public school since kindergarten. And my husband and I are very involved parents. We chaperone, we volunteer at book fairs, we just do whatever we can every year. And I'd recommend this if you're listening. You know, every year I always email my son's teacher at the beginning of the year and say, hey, you know, I'm available these days of the week. I'm available at home in the evenings if you have projects that you need me to do. And I always reach out as the school year starts so they know that I'm there for them. But what I will say is this. We know that the number one indicator of student success in school is the direct involvement of their parents or their families. You know, whatever type of family the child comes from. And so involving our families in the education of their children is vital. And kind of like you're saying, Sita, over the past few years, it seems like it's been schools or teachers versus families versus parents. And I will tell you that that doesn't benefit our kids.
No, we should work together. At the end of the day, if you want a kid to draw your blood when they grow up or fly an aircraft or be a nurse, we have to do it together, because when you get in that aircraft, it's almost like that kid belongs to all of us.
Absolutely.
Right?
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about the educational gaps and weaknesses in our district. Do you see any educational gaps and weaknesses in our district?
For sure. You know, there's been a lot of data that has come out in the last few months. And so my career as a teacher, I started down in Fort Pierce, and I worked at a school that was a K-8 school, a public school that was very diverse, and the majority of our students, about 90%, lived below the poverty line. And so there were many challenges. We also had many non-English speaking students and families. And so I saw the challenges that came with that at that particular school. When I came to Brevard County, I worked at Atlantis Elementary up in Port St. John as the shuttle program was shutting down. And so we saw some changes in that school. It actually became a Title I school. And to become a Title I school, you have to have a certain number of students, again, below the poverty line. As I was there, it was definitely a changing school as far as what we needed to offer to our families for our students to be successful. And then finally, I worked at Manatee Elementary in Vieira, where we had many stay-at-home moms who came in to volunteer on a regular basis. I had them in my classroom every single day. Thank goodness for them. And I also saw that when you have a lot of business owners who are parents at your school, how to involve those businesses in. And so when you ask about inequities, I have seen that firsthand. And one of the things that I really want to do on the school board is not only work to involve our families in different ways, you know, because at some schools, like I said, you can get parents in during the day, especially if they're not working and they don't, you know, that's an easier thing
to
do.
It all goes back to the socioeconomic standard of living and the zip code. You know,
for sure.
So what would you describe as an effective school board member? To you, what is an effective school board member?
Great question. You know, there are a lot of specifics that the school board members do. Things like approve the budget every year. And before running, I went and looked, you know, at the state statute for everything a school board member does. But I will say that I think it's vitally important that we listen, right? Because as a school board member, you're an elected representative. And I have said this multiple times, and I'm happy to have the chance to say it again, that I understand that when I'm on the school board, I don't just represent the families of students, or the students and the families who voted for me. You know, I represent every single family in the district.
Right.
And so I truly am here to listen to everyone
and learn
concern.
Along with them.
Yeah, because in the classroom, you know, all these students that I've taught for years, you don't think about politics, right? We need to keep politics out of the classrooms, and we need to focus on the children.
Right. So for listeners to tune in into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, we're speaking with Erica. We're speaking with Erin Dunn for School Board 2, District 2. I don't know where Erica came from, because there's an article here by an Erica. Ali, you have a fifth question for her, question number five. If we could get it in one minute, that would be great. 1 minute.
We were talking about maybe thinking outside the box with maybe some creative solutions to some issues that are within schools.
Yeah.
And getting maybe the buy-in from the teachers, at least, and the parents.
And the community.
And the community.
Well,
right.
You know, here's what
I'll... To do that outside the box.
Yeah,
thinking.
I will tell you that we have many... amazing community organizations, you know, from the Children's Hunger Project to Family Promise and Brevard Schools Foundation. So many organizations working parallel to solve some of these problems we talked about. I would love to be able to bring them together as much as possible. And like I said, solve some of those inequities across the district. And I will tell you this. It seems that a lot of people now want to attack our public schools and say that we need to bring new ideas in from the outside. But I will tell you that some of the best problem solvers are our teachers, because we can do a lot with nothing or very little. In the classroom, I put on a huge musical every year or so with 100 students with a budget of zero and no rehearsal time during the school day. So I figured out a way to get 100 kids, rehearse them, and put on huge musical productions with only parent volunteers and some teacher support.
So you're saying that you already have the teachers in place that are willing to work with the school board and with the parents.
Absolutely.
Listen to them. And hold regular meetings or something with them, make them feel included and respect them.
Yeah, and parents too. You know, I think if we can just sit down and talk and work together, that our kids will benefit.
Right.
That's what this is all about.
So give us your website one more time.
Absolutely.
And the date that your election will be decided.
So my election is August 23rd. There are four of us running, and if one of us gets 50% plus one vote, we win in August. Otherwise, we will also go to November. But my plan is to win on August 23rd. My website is www.erindunnforschools.com, and the four, just like Jessica, the four is a number four. erindunnforschools.com.
I like that you guys made it short. So we want to thank both of our guests who came in today. We had Jessica for judge, and it's actually Rick Seidler. Now I can
you
say it really well. Rick Seidler.
Rick Seidler.
I don't know why it was so hard before, right? Ali Tamber, thank you for co-hosting today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Erin Dunn, for school board.
Thank
for
you
District
so much,
two for coming in. Thank you, Danny, for running our board. And I tell you, every week we sit here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and I think we do make a difference in our community, and we talk about issues facing everyone, all of us, and voting. There's nothing more important to us right now than voting. If you don't vote, you don't have a voice to complain.
Exactly.
So we'll be back next week on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida.